Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here's the show that really puts Tuesday on a platform for years, and it just continues. So blessed to produce this. This is Cleveland, Ohio, and I know the Guardians are playing the Dodgers. I know the Browns are getting ready for the season. I know the Cavaliers are going to come around, but, man, American sports history takes center stage, right on top of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Hosted by a brother, a mentor, and a friend to me, Peter Ray. Over the years, I just love him tremendously. Yours truly, Mark Mancini, 2,500 miles to the west, not hanging on a palm tree in Los Angeles. 347-205-9631, if you happen to miss it, because I realize 30 goes by quick. Archive version, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So less of me, more of him. As I lay the red carpet down, I put the podium in its place. Hand over the mic, the threes, Peter. How are you? How can people get a hold of you? And you're bringing back another great guest that comes on the monthly visits to you.
Yeah.
Hi, Mark. I'm doing well. I have a YouTube channel. The channel name is my name, Peter J. Rea. You're absolutely right. Tonight's guest, every 4 weeks, is the author of four tremendous sports books: Bench Bosses, the NHL's Coaching Elite in 2015, The Art of the Dealers, the NHL's Greatest General Managers 2017, Lords of the Gridiron, College Football's Greatest Coaches 2019, and the book we're going to continue talking about tonight, Lords of the Gridiron 2, Pro Football's Greatest Coaches 2022. He's actually got two books coming out in 2026, Baseball's Greatest Managers and NBA's Greatest Coaches. What a pleasure, a tremendous opportunity to having again on the show, Mr. Matthew DiBiase.
Peter, Mark, it's great to be back again. It's always a privilege and an honor to be on your show. It's just, I love it so much, and I'm always grateful that you have me on. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Oh, well, thank you from the bottom of our hearts, because we get to delve into NFL history. You know, that's what this show is all about, history, and that's what we've been doing. We're up to... You had 50 guys you picked as the greatest NFL coaches. We've done the first 23. Tonight, we'll start off, we'll do Blanton Collier and Sean Payton. So let's start off with Blanton Collier. What do you have to say about him, Matthew?
I'll tell you this, for all you old Cleveland Browns fans, I mean, Blanton Collier, I when I was writing this chapter, I'm amazed that Blanton Collier is not in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I mean, the question is why? I mean, according to my calculations, he was the second best coach in the NFL after Vince Lombardi in the NFL, not counting the AFL, during the 1960s. Even though he did not coach during the entire decade, he was second only to Vince Lombardi. Another key point is that in terms of offense, you know which team had the greatest rushing offense during the 1960s? Do you think it was Vince Lombardi's Green Bay Packers? No. It was the Cleveland Browns, and for most part coached by Blanton Collier, because he had Jim Brown in the last three seasons of Jim Brown's illustrious career, and he also had Leroy Kelly. I mean, you would think, Jim Brown retired after the 65 season. You would think that would be a devastating blow to a franchise. I mean, in my opinion, the greatest running back in NFL history. And yet Blanton Collier replaced him with Leroy Kelly, and the Cleveland Browns kept winning and kept gaining yards like nothing had changed. When he took over in 1963, the Cleveland Browns hadn't been in the playoffs since 1958, and hadn't been to an NFL championship game since 57. And yet, in his second season, 64, he takes them all the way to the NFL championship game and wins. He beats the Baltimore Colts 34-0, and to this day, that is the last NFL championship ever won by the Cleveland Browns. And in the following year, he takes them back again, even though, sadly, they lose to the Green Bay Packers. And then when the NFL divided up into four divisions and they began divisional play, from 67 to 69, Cleveland Browns win three consecutive division titles. They twice beat the Dallas Cowboys, in 68 and 69. I mean, he was an absolutely brilliant coach. I mean, also... Not only was a great coach in his own right in terms of his players, but also developing other coaches. Don Shula got an early assistant coaching experience under Blanton Collier. Chuck Knox learned a lot about run blocking at the knee of Blanton Collier, which he later translated into his own brilliant NFL coaching career. He learned a lot of tricks about, you know, run blocking, you know, from Blanton Collier. I mean, he stated as such in his memoirs. Bill Arnsparker, who was Don Shula's defensive coordinator with Miami Dolphins, he coached under Blanton Collier. I mean, not only was he developing players, he was developing coaches too. Monty Clark, who was the offensive line coach for the Dolphins during their dynastic years under Shula, he played under Blanton Collier, and that's where he learned his run blocking techniques from, which he later helped me apply for Larry Zonka and Jim Kick and Mercury Morris. And the problem is, why isn't, you know, Blanton Collier in the Hall of Fame? And I think there's several reasons. One, he never took the Cleveland Browns to the Super Bowl. In 68 and 69, he was one win away from earning a Super Bowl berth. But in both instances, in 68 and 69, he's totally blown out, first by the Baltimore Colts, who beat him 34-0 in the 68 NFL Championship game. And then in the following year, they lose to the Minnesota Vikings 27-7 in the NFL Championship game. I think that's one factor. Another factor is that Collier himself was literally the quiet man. He was such a shy, retiring gentleman, never tooted his own horn. And that's kind of fatal. Because if you want Hall of Fame recognition, you've got to be able to either toot your own horn, or you have enough, you know, high connected, you know, players or coaches to toot your own horn, or journalists who can toot your horn for you. And Collier was not like that. I mean, he was literally the invisible man by his own design. He just that was his nature, that shyness and all that. And I think that cost him. And it's a shame. I hope, you know, that's why when I wrote my book, I made the case for him. I mean, he ranks higher than Mike Ditka, and he's in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, you know, as a coach. He outranks, you know, Hank Stram. He's in the Hall of Fame as a coach. You know, Don Coryell, by a wide margin, he outranks Don Coryell, who's just been inducted in the Hall of Fame as a coach. Sid Gilman. I hope someday even though it's posthumous because he's been dead for over 30, you know, almost 40 years now, I hope he'll eventually earn recognition. He truly deserves it. One of the great coaches of the 1960s, in my view.
Yeah, well, I'd like to read from your chapter. Although he only coached 7 years of the decade, he was the second greatest head coach in the NFL during the 1960s, according to my rating system. Collier successfully handled the nearly impossible task of succeeding Paul Brown with incredible grace, sensitivity, and tact, including leading the Browns to back-to-back NFL championship game appearances in 1964 and 1965. So why isn't he in the Hall of Fame? The answer lies within the man himself. Len Collier was the quintessential quiet man, yielding the spotlight to his players. He never tooted his own horn, which is a violation of the late United Mine Workers founder John L. Lewis credo. I love this quote, "He who tooteth not his own horn, the same shall not be tooted." The fact that Collier won an NFL title during the pre-Super Bowl era may also count against him, since there is a sad tendency among football writers to forget or disregard the pre-Super Bowl era champions in both the NFL and AFL. Now you have a quote from Chuck Knox, another tremendous coach. "Call him my greatest influence, Len Collier.
Yeah.
Call him my mentor. Call him whatever. This soft-spoken gentleman is a part of everything I've ever accomplished." And let's see, I got some more here. All right.
Yeah.
And you talked about Leroy Kelly as one of his tremendous running back. You called him a Schwerpunkt. Wow, wonderful German word. I'm almost done here. Okay, teammate Ernie Kellerman states, "I remember Blanton Collier as a quiet taskmaster. During games when things weren't going right, he never blew a gasket. I never remembered him raising his voice. He would speak to you in terms of drawing you out. If you goofed up or made a mistake, he would review the play with you afterwards or even during the game in a quick manner. He could see things going wrong, and conversing with his staff on his phones, he pretty much knew who was making a mistake on a play. And if you came out, he'd get in your face, not in an argumentative way, but in a teaching type of way, stern, kind of yelling, but not overbearing or losing his cool out there, but trying to make you realize that you did screw up and why you screwed up, and you let him know in no uncertain terms that it wouldn't happen again if the same play occurred. But his manner was demonstrative, but tactful. Now you concluded, let this chapter, I love this, be used as evidence of his worthiness for being inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame as a builder, and let the following words from Fair Hooker, tremendous wide receiver, stand up as eulogy of Blaine Collier as a coach. I loved Blaine Collier. He was a guy that you played for because you felt good playing for him. Whatever you said, you knew he was going to back up. If he said something, you knew he was going to do it. You felt good playing for him because he was that type of person, that type of personality. He was a person you wanted to play for. He was a player's coach. Any more thoughts on Blanton Collier, Matthew?
Basically, before he became a football coach, he was a teacher. He grew up in Kentucky, and he actually was taught at local schools there. And then during World War II, he was working at Great Lakes Naval Training Station, and that's where he encountered Paul Brown. And he basically was learning football under Paul Brown, and Paul Brown liked him in return. And when Paul Brown created the Cleveland Browns, Blanton Collier worked with him as an assistant coach there until 1953. And, again, absorbing Paul Brown's systems and all that. I mean, they were close friends, but as the years passed, there was like a divide between the two. Because in many ways, when Blanton Collier succeeded Paul Brown as head coach of the Browns, Paul Brown never forgave him for that. He never did. And that's kind of like a sad part about Brown. I mean, he resented the fact that Collier was his successor. And that led to a cooling in their relationship, because when Paul Brown later coached the Cincinnati Bengals and they were divisional rivals in the AFC with the Browns, Brown was very frosty with Collier there. I mean, it's that type of pennies that kind of makes you wince. But getting back to Collier as a teacher, he introduced the concept of option blocking, which was rather innovative at the time. In the old days, when you were doing blocking patterns, you had to take your man in a certain way, but Collier thought, no, it didn't make sense. If you did your initial block, his concept was just take the guy in the direction you're going. You don't have to force him in a specific direction. Just take him in the best direction you can go, and it was up to the running back, in this case Jim Brown or someone else, but mostly Jim Brown, had the option of choosing his holes. In other words, don't go to a predetermined hole. Just find out where the holes are naturally developing and run to daylight and all that. And that's why when in Blanton Collier's first season in 63, Jim Brown set an NFL record of gaining 1,863 yards rushing, which stood it for 10 years until O.J. Simpson broke it. And, I mean, again, it was that innovative approach. Also, unlike Paul Brown, he gave the quarter. He didn't call the plays. He let, you know, Paul Ryan, you know, to call his own games and all that. He gave the players greater input, whereas Paul Brown never allowed the players input. And they were supposed to follow his edicts and all that. You know, Jim Brown was able to contribute to the game plan there. In other words, which plays work and which plays don't. Everyone had a chance to contribute, and that was really a big boon for morale. And that's why the Browns really exploded under Blanton Collier during his first three seasons, 63, 64, 65. And that's why they went to the NFL championship game in 64 and 65. Just Jim Brown said the last three seasons of his career was the most fun he ever had as a player, and I think that made an enormous amount of difference. And even after Brown retired, you know, again, you know, Leroy Kelly was just gaining those yardage there, just tearing up, the opponents and all that. And he got Bill Nelson, who took over from Paul Ryan there. And Bill Nelson, even though he had the worst knees in the NFL, probably the only one who had probably worse knees was Joe Namath. Nelson had such leadership skills, he was able to take him to those three straight division titles and all of that in 67, 68, and 69. And I think Collier, he was not like a Lombardi type, a real motivational speaker. He outthought you. And he give him time. He could design game plans. I mean, he's able to beat Tom Landry's flex defense in 68 and 69. I mean, that 69 game, I mean, they gained 380-yard total offense against the flex defense. And they beat the Dallas Cowboys 38-14. I mean, it was a humiliation. I mean, that's an amazing thing to be able to get the better of, you know, great coaches, you know, like, you know, George Halas or Tom Landry. or guys like that. And it just, I think it's unfair that he's been denied, you know, induction in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And I hope someday the powers that be there do give him that induction.
Yeah, I appreciate, as a Cleveland Browns fan, I appreciate you promoting him, and I love the chapter. And, of course, these big names, Jim Brown, Leroy Kelly, Paul Brown, Don Shula, Chuck Knox, Frank Ryan, Paul Warfield, Gary Collins, Bill Nelson. Let's move on to Sean Payton, number 25 on your list.
The man who finally made the New Orleans Saints winners and playoff contenders and Super Bowl champions. For so long, ever since they played their first game in 67, the Saints were literally, you could almost say, a boil on the buttocks of the NFL. Just always in the basement. I mean, very few playoff appearances, very few winning seasons. I mean, the only thing easy in the Big Easy, was it was easy to lose. It was just, you know, a defeat was always a given. It was like a graveyard for great coaches. I mean, Hank Stram ended his NFL coaching career there, and actually he lost value, you know, according to my rating system, because he coached there. Dick Nolan, who won three straight division titles of the 49ers, tried to coach there, and that's during those dark days when fans were wearing bags over their heads because they were just losing constantly. I mean, it was just Jim Mora came from the USFL and coached there. Actually got into the playoffs a few times, but he couldn't take them far, couldn't get him to the Super Bowl. I mean, it was a pathetic thing. And then finally, when they hired Sean Payton in 2006, this was in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. They were just beginning to play their games in the Superdome again. And literally, it was a rebuilding project. I mean, not just the team, but the city as a whole. And just through his brilliance. I mean, Brian Kelly was one of the greatest running coaches of all time. Sean Payton, to this day, is one of the greatest passing coaches of all time. I mean, right up there with Bill Walsh, Sid Gilman, and Don Corio. I mean, probably the greatest passing coach of the 21st century. I mean, his innovations in passing, you know, in the passing game were absolutely stupendous. And during the 2010s, New Orleans always had one of the best offenses and one of the greatest passing offense in the NFL there. I mean, he was born in California, and not exactly a really stupendous high school player, but even in high school, he was so smart. I mean, his high school coach would allow Sean input in preparing game plans, and he told him, don't, you know, work on your football IQ, because that's really going to stand you in good stead and all that. And even then, he had the coaching bug in him. I mean, he was like a coach on the field. Now, he never played Division I-A college football. He played Division I-AA, which is like the next rung down. And he was at Eastern Illinois. And actually, he set a lot of records there. I mean, he was a very good, a fantastic quarterback there. And if I recall correctly, I mean, he set passing records. I think they still stand today, you know, in terms of Eastern Illinois, you know, football history there. And the thing is, though, he was Division I-AA team. He wasn't really – I don't think he was drafted in the NFL, but he still got to play in the NFL anyway, because in 87 when they had that strike, he was a scab player for the Chicago Bears. He was a scab. Yeah, he was one of the scabs there. And actually, he made a bit of an impression with Mike Ditka. And Sean Payton is always grateful for Ditka for giving him a chance, and he made a good impression. But his playing career ended, and he got straight into coaching. And he was coaching in college. He was working at San Diego State, Indiana State, Miami at Ohio, and Illinois, either coaching running backs or receivers or out serving as an offensive coordinator. He finally got his first NFL coaching gig in 97 when he was working as a quarterbacks coach for Ray Rhodes and John Gruden. So he's already part of that, you know, that network exists, because, you know, Gruden was part of that Mike Holmgren, Bill Walsh, you know, coaching tree and all that. So he's getting those connections and all of that. And people were noticing him. And then he moves on to the New York Giants, and he was quarterback's coach for Jim Fossil when they had that Super Bowl appearance where they were blown out by the Baltimore Ravens. Yeah, he was the quarterback's coach, and he got that great season out of Kerry Collins. But then the Giants kind of went south. and he had to, it was kind of rough for a while there. And in fact, Fassel was taking away Sean Payton's play calling things, and finally he left, and he had a key break when Bill Parcells, who was coaching the Dallas Cowboys, picked him up there, and he spent three seasons with Parcells, and that was the big ticket punch. I mean, he learned a lot under Parcells. I mean, he was learning, you know, basically the motivational aspect of the game, you know, how Parcells would use psychological pressure to get more out of his players, but also, you know, putting his coaches on their toes, too. In other words, he was always testing you. In other words, are you up for this? You know, an assistant coach, I think we ought to do this, and Parcells would always challenge him. Are you sure about this? Do you really think it stands up? And I meant you had to be able to argue your position there. In other words, the stronger your arguments were, the more you could convince Parcells, the more respect he showed for you. How to avoid complacency? You know, if there was not, where it wasn't a state of crisis, how about creating an artificial crisis that would help bring the team together and all that? I mean, that was a lot of what he applied when he was coaching the New Orleans Saints. He learned from Parcells there. I mean, he, Belichick, and Tom Coughlin are the three greatest students under the Bill Parcells coaching tree, according to my calculations there. And then finally he gets the New Orleans coaching gig. And when he left Dallas, Parcells said, Sean, one piece of advice, you better very quickly figure out why New Orleans can never ever win, because if you can't figure that out, guess what? Two or three years from now, you're going to get fired, and they're going to have a press conference announcing that you just got fired. So that's your challenge. Figure out why they keep losing. And very quickly, he figured it out. I mean, like I said, it's the big easy. You can go to a strip joint or a bar, or a restaurant at 4 o'clock in the morning. He said the temptations were always out there. So basically he imposed this very rigorous discipline, and he held players to it. And he had the full backing of the front office, his general manager there. And he cracked that whip. And then also he was, you know, teaching him his passing systems. And then of course the biggest break of all, they won the free agency building for Drew Brees. If they don't get Drew Brees, there is no way Sean Payton could have led that team to the Super Bowl. They might have been able to win a little bit, but they would never have gone all the way. Drew Brees was to New Orleans what Brady was to Belichick at New England there, the key. I mean, Brees was just the ultimate quarterback. I mean, absolutely dead-eye. And now that he's got his quarterback, all he had to do was find, you know, the blockers to give Drew Brees the protection, and even more importantly, the pass catchers. And that is where Sean Payton's innovations come from in terms of passing offense. It's interesting. He used a defensive concept. You know, you have in defense, you know, blitz packages, you know, in terms of, you know, how to do a pass rush. He wanted to use it on the offensive side, using wide receivers, kind of like blitzing linebackers. You know, using all five of his receivers, he wanted to do a simultaneous assault on a team's defenses there. Some teams, all they go, okay, we're just going to strictly look deep, and we're strictly going to look for the deep man. No, under Sean Payton, all five men are in on the play there, and it was up to Drew Brees to very quickly find whatever open man was there. It could be short, it could be in the middle range, or it could be deep. But the question is, of the five men who are out there ready to catch a pass, one of them is going to be open. And the question was speed. It was timing, because Drew Brees, of course, was one of the most accurate, deadly accurate quarterbacks in NFL history. So since it was given that he was deadly accurate, it was also equally imperative for his pass catchers. Could be the running backs, it could be the tight end, or the two wideouts, to execute their patterns to a T. In other words, split to a second. I mean, there could be no stutter steps, no hesitation. You had to be at the right spot at the right time. And if you were at the right spot at the right time, the ball was going to be there. But it was up to you to get it. And I think another brilliant part of Sean Payton was that when he would sign a receiver, he would always drill his receivers extensively to figure out what patterns they could execute well and what they could not execute well. When he sent a pass catcher out on a pattern, it was always in a pattern that the man could execute, whether it was short yardage or mid-range or deep. He would never ask you to do something that you could not do. He managed to get maximum use out of all his pass catchers. In other words, when that man was going out for a pass, he was in the best possible pattern and position to get maximum effect after he caught that ball and all that. And that's why he got such high performance from his pass catchers there. I mean, and again, that's why, you know, during the 2010s, New Orleans just dominated the passing statistics there in yardage, receptions, everything.
Yeah, now in your chapter, you talked about, Bill Parcells, how he was so important for him. And then you talked about, how he had to in New Orleans, he had to create a culture of urgency.
Yeah.
And that they, they needed to get something going to get out of this lethargic mediocrity that had become so prevalent. And he talked about, you talk a lot about Drew Brees, how important he was to the team, and how he imitated Bill Walsh before the Super Bowl, and he dressed up as a bellman to greet the team when they reached the hotel in Miami. And then another, near the end, general manager Mickey Loomis said, that if they didn't, without Sean Payton, they would not have won a Super Bowl. Now, we got 4 minutes left. We got some comments here. I appreciate the comments. There just isn't much time here. But anyway, I'll just throw them all at you, Matthew. Jerry from Napa, California, is interested in Jim and John Harbaugh. Denton from Shreveport, Louisiana, well, we talked about Sean Payton. He says he's the best. Carl from Beaumont, Texas. Tony Dungy is interested in him. Big B from Jacksonville, Florida. Tom Coughlin. Lance from Pensacola, Florida. Sid Gilman and Dick LeBeau. And so any thoughts on any of those comments, Matthew?
For the guy I mentioned, Tony Dungy, we already discussed Tony Dungy many months ago. So go back through Peter Ray's archives, and you'll see our show on Tony Dungy there. We will be talking about Tom Coughlin at about 2-3 months from now, because he's coming up, down the road here. Not next show, but I think maybe like 2-3 months from now, we'll be talking about Tom Coughlin. So just be patient. He'll come up. We'll be discussing him for sure. Let's see, who else was mentioned there? I forget. Sid Gilman. We'll be talking about Sid Gilman, but he's way down the road. I mean, he's like in the 40s there. So we still got we'll talk about him probably next year. Okay. probably next year, since we go every 4 weeks and all that, but be patient. We'll talk about Sid Gilman. Absolutely. Positively.
Yeah. You got Tony Dungy just looking at the list here. Let's see. Tony Dungy is number 13 and, let's see, you've got Tom Coughlin, 29. Any other, how about Jim and John Harbaugh?
Well, Jim Harbaugh, not with the pros, because he didn't play long enough to re-rate my system, but John, it definitely will be featured. He's in the low 30s. So I think sometime next year we'll be talking about John Harbaugh. We'll be talking about John Harbaugh before we talk about Sid Gilman. Okay, but definitely, we'll be talking about John Harbaugh, absolutely, positively. So just stay tuned and be patient, okay?
Dick LeBeau.
Well, he not as a head coach in the NFL. I mean, he was a brilliant defensive coordinator, but as a head coach, no. He did not rank among my top 50, okay, as a head coach.
Where is Dick Vermeil?
Not in the top 50. Remember, I think we talked about it. I had him like 58th or something like that, because people forget – he had some lean years with the Eagles and lean years with the Rams and the Chiefs. If he had stayed with the Rams instead of retiring after he won that Super Bowl and gotten the same results as Mike Martz, he definitely would have ranked among the top 50 and would have been discussed in my book. He later said that was a big mistake leaving Los Angeles. He's right. That was a big mistake. He should have stayed.
Our guest has been Matthew DiBiase. We've been talking about his wonderful book, Lords of the Gridiron, Two Pro Football's Greatest Coaches, which came out in 2022. Matthew, do you have any final words tonight for our audience?
It's great being on this show, and I'm working on my latest book about the 50 greatest baseball managers of all time. That will come out in April 2026, and also in October 2026. I'll be revealing the top 50 NBA head coaches of all time. So just hang in there, sports fans, and 3 years down the road, you'll be getting new product out of me.
Well, thanks again, Matthew, for a wonderful stroll through NFL history. Tremendous.
Thank you, Peter, and God bless you.
God bless you. Next week, we're going to have the starting center fielder and leadoff hitter from the coolest MLB team of all time for the 28th time, Mr. Bill North. In 2 weeks, we will have Kip Gross, who played pro baseball from 1990 to 2000 in MLB and in Japan. And let's see, what did I say? In 2 weeks, yeah. So anyway, everything's good. Dear listener, may the road rise to meet you. Oh, I forgot. Now, in 4 weeks from tonight, let's see, 4 weeks from tonight, September 19th, we're going to, with Matthew Dibiaz, we'll talk about Greasy Neal, Philadelphia Eagles in the 1940s, and Maurice Schottenheimer with the Browns, Chiefs, Redskins, and Chargers from 1984 to 2006.
Yes.
Dear listener, may the road rise to meet you. May the wind be at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face and rains fall soft upon your fields. And
yes,
until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Good night, everybody. Thanks again so much, Mr. Matthew Dibiaz.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Mark. God bless you all.
God bless you.
All right.